What I want to talk to you about here this morning is a subject that Andy and I spoke of before the semester even started. We were talking about having me come on out and share. And what I want to speak about is the subject of church government. But it's a little bit different for me than what I usually do. I mean, look, my real heart, my real passion as a Bible teacher, as a pastor, is to be a Bible expositor. I love taking a passage and just breaking it down verse by verse. I feel that's what I'm called to do and where my heart beats in the teaching and preaching ministry. Nevertheless, on the topic of church government, I think it's a difficult way to approach that subject because in my mind, there may be people who disagree, but in my mind, there's no one go-to passage in the New Testament that speaks about the structure of church government. So what I'm going to give to you today isn't so much an exposition, even though we'll be taking a look at a few scriptural passages. More so, I'm going to deliver to you four points or principles that I think are very important for us to grab a hold of regarding church government in the New Testament. So you ready for this? We'll put them up on the PowerPoint, but you should take notes too because it'll just help you to retain it better. Number one, the New Testament does not command any particular structure of church government. I believe that. I think when you take a look at the New Testament, there is no go-to verse, there is no go-to chapter, there is no detailed description of how a church government's structure should be. Now, we read of many titles for leaders in the church. You have elders and pastors and deacons and apostles and overseers. But you know, their relationship with one another and their relationship with the congregation is not really described or detailed. Bible doesn't tell you how many elders you're supposed to have, how many pastors, what the structure is with overseers, how many deacons, how they're to be appointed, on and on. We have some principles, but there is no detailed structure given to us in the New Testament. And now, we read many things that really enlighten us about the mentality and the heart that leaders should have. There's a lot of that in the New Testament. I mean, I think immediately of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 20, starting at verse 25. These are familiar verses to you, I hope. But just soak it in as I read this to you. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Isn't that a powerful principle for how churches should be governed? But what I'm getting at is that tells you a lot about heart. It tells you a lot about mentality. But it doesn't tell you anything about structure. Or how about this, in 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 2 and 3, "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." Again, there's not a lot in there to grab a hold of relevant to structure. I think there's a little bit, and we'll talk about that later. But the Bible just doesn't give us a detailed structure for the government of the church in the New Testament. And many scholars see this and understand it. Let me just read you a few quotes from some New Testament scholars and historians. First of all, from Philip Schaff. Quote, "At the time he," that is Jesus, "laid down no minute arrangements, but only the simple and necessary elements of an organization, wisely leaving the details to be shaped by the growing and changing wants of the church in different ages and countries." Now, another one from a man named Williston Walker, who wrote a classic history of Christianity. Quote, "No question in church history has been more darkened by controversy than that of the origin and development of church offices. And none is more difficult owing to the scantiness of the evidence that has survived. It is probable that the development was diverse in different localities. Not all early Christian congregations had identical institutions at the same time." And then if I could tax your patience with one more from a very respected scholar, one of my favorite Bible commentators. Some people like to ask me, well, who are my favorite Bible commentators? I'll tell you one of them, the man I'm going to quote right now, a man named Leon Morris. He's since gone to his reward with the Lord. But Leon Morris is an excellent Bible commentator. He says this quote in the Baker's Dictionary of Theology. It is better to recognize that in the New Testament church, there were elements that were capable of being developed into the Episcopal, Presbyterian, and congregational systems, and which, in point of fact, have so developed. But while there is no reason why any modern Christian should not hold fast to his particular church polity and rejoice in the values it secures to him, that does not give him license to unchurch others whose reading of the evidence is different. See, folks, this is the way I see it. I believe that God deliberately left the specifics of church government flexible so that they could adapt to changing people, in changing situations, in changing cultures. If somebody wants to have a congregational form of church government, where basically things are done by congregational vote, my wife grew up in Sweden, and many, if not most, churches in Sweden are governed by congregational form of church government. She's told me of fights at congregational church meetings over what kind of coffee cups they were going to buy for the church. Now, if you want to have a congregational form of church government, go right ahead. There is some, I believe very small, but some evidence in the New Testament for that kind of church government. Then again, there's another form of church government that people call elder-led or Presbyterian, presbyteros being the New Testament word in Greek for elders, an elder-led form of church government. There's some evidence biblically for that structure of church government, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But then the third category of church government, not congregational, not elder-led strictly, is pastor-led, where you have a pastor who takes the lead in shepherding the church. If somebody wants to have any one of those three, I won't dispute it biblically. I may dispute it practically. I may dispute it pragmatically. But there's not necessarily a biblical argument against it, because there may be reasons why a particular form of church government works better in many different given factors. I may just tell you something that can affect this. It can be affected by the people available for leadership. What if a community of Christians needs some kind of leadership, but frankly, there's nobody there who can really step forward and take charge? Wouldn't it be better then to distribute the authority and the working of the church among several people? Or maybe it's a time of great crisis. Maybe it has to do with the spiritual maturity of the congregation. Maybe it has to do with the community where the ministry happens, the strengths, the weaknesses, the values of that particular community. And again, sometimes in a particular crisis, especially strong leadership is needed. So I believe that God deliberately left it somewhat vague so that things could adapt towards different people, different cultures, different situations. So in the way that church government structures actually work, sometimes the Holy Spirit guides in flexible, adaptable ways. There isn't always a one-size-fits-all. Now, I know this from my earliest days of ministry. I began informal ministry, when I said, actually going from teaching home Bible studies to, if you would call it that, pastoring a church in the early 1980s. Nobody gasp, please. In the early 1980s. But as a rather young man, another gentleman and myself, his name is Lance Ralston, and we started together Calvary Chapel of Oxnard. And let me tell you something. The first Sunday that we started Calvary Chapel in Oxnard, I was 19 years old, and Lance Ralston was, I don't know, probably 23 or 24 years old. And we didn't know hardly anything. Matter of fact, we were so ignorant, we didn't even know what we were ignorant of. Oh, we loved the Lord. We knew his word. We had a passion for serving God's people. But you know what? We really didn't have all that much practical exposure to ministry. And we didn't really have anybody looking over us. We weren't a church plant from anywhere. We basically joined together two home Bible studies and started Calvary Chapel of Oxnard. Well, let me tell you something. God really blessed it. And one of the things that he blessed in those early years was that Lance Ralston and myself, we worked together in a co-pastor arrangement. And it worked beautifully for us. It worked beautifully because we really needed each other, and we ended up teaching each other and discipling each other in ministry in a very precious way that I don't even think we were completely aware of at the time. But looking back, we go, wow, God really used that. But I'll tell you what, as Lance developed in his skills and capability and maturity and experience in ministry, and as I developed along the same lines, we discovered that while the co-pastor arrangement worked great in those early years, what a church couldn't have was two lead pastors. That really didn't work. And so we understood at the time that it would be best for me to move on, and I went over and started Calvary Chapel of Simi Valley. But what I'm just trying to tell you is that it was an adaptable arrangement, suitable to where the congregation was, suitable to where Lance and I were in our own development, and God used it in a great way. I think sometimes we forget this, that there is somewhat of an adaptability in church government structures. I've got a friend who's a pastor in Germany, and his name is Falk. And Falk is a wonderful man and a good pastor of his congregation. And one time we were discussing these things, and he was telling me about his experience on a volunteer fire department in Germany. In Germany, they have a lot of volunteer fire departments. And he was telling me about how things run in the structure there. And he goes, you know what? Most every day of the year, it is an incredibly democratic institution, our volunteer fire department. Man, we're joking around the firehouse. We're all working together in the training. We're doing this and that. And nobody really feels like they're above anybody else, but it's just wonderful community there. He goes, but when there's a crisis, when the fire bell rings, he goes, it's amazing how hierarchical that institution becomes. Suddenly, there's a very defined chain of leadership, and there's a guy leading saying, you put that hose over there. You go in with this ladder. You go in for the rescue. And somebody's really running the show. And he goes, it's not as if one excludes the other. There can be an adaptability in tone and in manner. And I think that was a very wise insight. I think this also is relevant to what I've observed from my years doing ministry in Europe to the general scene of pastoral ministry in Europe. In Europe, it's my observation that generally speaking, again, this isn't a 100% true thing, but generally speaking, people are afraid of the pastoral leadership model in Europe. They really have it ingrained in their mind that church government should be congregational. And so often they're very shy of any institution where somebody just says, hey, I'm sort of led of the Lord here and I'm going to lead and let's go together and see what God has for me. Therefore, I have recommended to several European Calvary Chapel pastors, you know what, I think you should have the ideal of a pastor-led church government, but be slow about how you get there. Bring the people along. Show them that you can be trusted. Show them that their fears are ungrounded. And if you give it time and if you give it diligence and a sacrificial heart, you will see that they'll come along to understanding and appreciating the pastor-led model, but don't expect to impose it upon them right away. They'll likely buck at it and you'll have more trouble than you think. So again, I'm just trying to stress this general point back to the very first point I made, that the New Testament does not command any particular structure of church government. But number two, and this is an extremely second point to follow up on, when it comes to church government, character is far more important than structure. As I said before, when you look at leadership structures in the early church, you just don't find much at all. You don't find instructions on how many elders you should have. You don't have instructions on what their specific responsibilities are. General, yes. Specific, no. You don't have instructions on how they should relate to the pastor and so forth. You won't find the minutes of an elders meeting in the New Testament. What you will find is a lot of teaching on character. Friends, this is a principle to really grab a hold of. The godliness of the leaders is far more important than the structure of the leadership. If you have godly leaders, any form of church government can function. Now, this is important to understand, because sometimes when people have problems in churches, especially when they have personal conflicts with those in leadership, oftentimes they want to blame not only the leaders, they want to blame the particular structure that was used at that church. And the bottom line is, just as I said before, any form of church government can work and work well depending on the godliness of the people in the structure. What I'm just trying to say is this. You show me whatever church structure you want to find, and I'll show you horror stories from that church structure. Congregational, I'll show you congregations dividing over what color the carpet should be in the basement. Elder rule, I'll show you pastors who have been run out on a rail because they offended one of the key elders in the church. Pastor led, I'll show you pastors who act essentially as dictators and lord it over their congregations in direct disobedience to 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. But you see, those problems aren't necessarily with a particular structure. Those problems are with the character of the individuals involved. Sometimes when people want to prove their point, because I've been in some debates with guys who champion, especially I've been in debates with guys who want to champion the elder-led model, and there's other guys who want to champion the pastor-led model, like myself. I advocate for the pastor-led model where applicable. I agree it's not applicable in every circumstance, but where applicable, I argue for that, and I'll speak about that in a moment. But in debating with people who want to champion the elder-led model, this is what I often find. They like to compare the best of their model with the worst of another model. And that's not fair. You know, there they are depicting the thing where all the elders are deeply pious men of God who wait on the Holy Spirit for every word and lead with that rare combination of authority yet gentleness. And they work together in perfect communion and support on and on and on. Opposed to, on the other side, you know, a pastor who's practically the spawn of Satan in the church. And friends, can I just say that that's not a fair comparison at all, to take the best from one model and compare it to the worst of another model. No, again, there are unwise and occasionally ungodly pastors who rule in a manner that's contrary to the scriptures. There are pastors who refuse to take counsel from anybody. From elders, from fellow pastors, from the people around them in their congregation. There are pastors who are headstrong and dictatorial. And let me tell you something about those men. They're fools. Even if their churches are successful by some outward measures, those men are fools and they plot their own destruction. Let me read to you just four quick verses from the Proverbs. Ready for this? Where there is no counsel, the people fail. But in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. That's Proverbs 11:4. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. Proverbs 12:1. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. Proverbs 12:15. By pride comes nothing but strife, but with the well-advised is wisdom. Proverbs 13:10. So again, does this mean that a pastor should just submit all leadership to a majority vote? Not necessarily at all. But what I'm saying is the pastor that leads in a dictatorial, isolated, ivory tower kind of way, I think is not wise and in some ways plots their own destruction. But whatever their foolish actions are, it doesn't make that form of church government unbiblically. It just shows that they apply their structure of church government in an unbiblical and in a foolish manner. In the same way, I would say this, that the renegade dictatorial elder does not disqualify his form of church government. He only shows his heart to be wrong. All right, that's my second point, that character is more important than structure. If you can get men of godly character, then the structure things will work out much more easily. So, number one, if there is no specific New Testament form of church government commanded, and number two, if character is more important than any structure, then why would I or anybody else try to make the case for the pastor-led model? Let me tell you why I would make the case for the pastor-led model. Because it's biblical. And it's biblical according to the New Testament. I know that sometimes the pastor-led model is called the Moses model. I think in some ways that is a helpful illustration of the principle from the Old Testament. But I want you to know that I don't follow that particular form of church government because it's the Moses model. I follow it because it's the New Testament model of church government. What do I mean by that? Think of how structures and governments are arranged in the New Testament. How often do you find leadership by committee? How often? Is it common to find it in the New Testament? Well, let's just think through this problem together. Number one, you have Jesus. Did Jesus lead by committee? What was his structure of leadership? Jesus didn't leave things up to the majority vote of the disciples. If he did, I don't think he would have ever gone to the cross. He didn't even lead things up to, if you will call, the elders among the disciples. Doesn't it seem, and I know this is debated on some points, but I don't want to get into the debate, but just to say, doesn't it seem that in some ways maybe Peter, James, and John were sort of an inner circle within the disciples? Well, he didn't leave it up to them as being like the elders of the greater group of Jesus plus the 12. No, Jesus led. Certainly he led with love, humility, sensitivity, but there was no doubt that Jesus was the leader of that group. Now, please understand, certainly I'm not trying to say that pastors are Jesus. Jesus is the head of his church, and Jesus should be recognized as the head of the church, no matter what form of church government anybody adopts. But simply I'm saying that Jesus' model of church government himself was not to lead by committee, and he's the one who told us, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. Well, maybe that just ended with Jesus. But think about Paul and the other disciples. Paul and the other apostles, in their leadership of churches in the first century, did they lead by committee? Does anybody think that when Paul spent 2 years or more in Corinth, or more than that years in Ephesus, does anybody think that at that time Paul really led by committee? The entire tenor of Paul's ministry as described in Acts and his epistles makes it very difficult to believe that he was just one voice among many as a committee or group of elders, and that Paul had no greater voice than anybody else did as a team or a committee. Friends, Paul was a leader, and he led. Now again, I'm not trying to argue today that senior pastors are same as those first century apostles. No, they're not. But again, they're doing what Paul said to do. He said to follow his example in ministry. Just as Paul said, therefore I urge you, imitate me. Paul and the apostles, their model of ministry, as far as structure goes, was not leadership by committee. Well, next I want you to think about Timothy and Titus. What about them? Well, how did they function in Ephesus and in Crete, respectively? Did Timothy work just as one elder among many? Or did Titus function the same way in Crete? Or did Timothy and Titus work in a way that was much more analogous to the model of senior pastor leadership? Well, of course they did. Why else would Paul leave to Timothy and to Titus the authority to appoint elders themselves? Do you understand that? When Paul gave the commission to Timothy to appoint elders, when Paul gave the commission to Titus to appoint elders, he didn't say, now the first thing you got to do is get together a selection committee because this is a decision you can never make on your own. No, he told them to lead. Choose men who can lead and serve in these churches. He said this to Titus in Titus chapter 1, verse 5, for this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set things in order, the things that are lacking, and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. You know, they were given the authority, both Timothy and Titus, to appoint leaders and to train them, and they did it clearly directed by the Holy Spirit through the Apostle Paul. Well, then I'll give you a fourth example. Actually, you might say a fifth because Titus and Timothy could be counted as one example each, but let's just say it's the fourth example. You have James in Jerusalem. You know, if you consider Acts chapter 15, the Jerusalem Council, some people say, see, this is leadership by committee. Not so fast. It's true that at the Jerusalem Council, that a whole group of apostles and elders got together to work out the thorny issue of do Gentiles need to become Jews before they can become Christians. And this was a critical issue to discover. And so they got together as a group of apostles and elders, and they debated through the issue. But this is what I want you to observe. After all of their debating, James stood up in Acts chapter 15, verse 19, and he pronounced a definitive conclusion. After all, James was, so to speak, the pastor at the church at Jerusalem. James presided over the Jerusalem Council, and this is what he said after all the input, after all the discussion had been made. James got up and he says, this is in Acts chapter 15, verse 25. He says, it seemed good to me. Excuse me, that's Acts chapter 15, verse 19. Excuse me, where he says this. I misquoted that. He says, therefore I judge. James made the decision. Who made the decision at the Acts Council? At the Jerusalem Council, I should say, in the book of Acts? It was James making the decision because he was the presiding pastor of the church at Jerusalem. Matter of fact, the ancient Greek puts it even more strongly. James says, I determine, I resolve. And if you get into the Greek behind it and look at the Greek commentators, they'll look, no, James is very strongly saying, this is how we're doing it. Now, others instantly supported him. That's where it says in Acts chapter 15, verse 25, it seemed good to us and the Holy Spirit. But make no mistake about it, James took leadership at the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15. Well, if there's one passage that people love to go to and say, see, the church did not have the pastor-led model. Instead, they used this model of a plurality of elders leading each individual church with no pastor-led model. One of the places they love to go to is in Acts chapter 20, where Paul speaks to the Ephesian elders. You know, may I say, I am especially grateful to a man named Justin Alford for his research and his writing on this particular subject. Many of these points are taken from an excellent paper that he himself did, and I'm especially grateful for his insights on this particular point. Because when you read of Paul speaking to the Ephesian elders, it makes you feel like, wow, there's this great big church in Ephesus, and you've got all these elders who rule and shepherd. They must have done this all with a team leadership with no pastor leading. But friends, that's to misread the situation of the New Testament church completely. When you have all those Ephesian elders, now, we don't know exactly how many believers there were in Ephesus. We know that a mighty work of God was done there, according to Acts chapters 18, 19, and 20. But what we do know is that there were many people, probably thousands of believers in Ephesus. And here's the point. They did not meet in one great big congregation. There were no facilities for meeting that way. The Ephesian church was broken up by necessity, not by choice, but by necessity into house churches. And it is entirely probable, not just plausible, but probable, that the Ephesian elders were the pastors of the individual house churches. That is a much more plausible and probable accounting of those Ephesian elders than to imagine that they sort of sat as a board over one giant congregation. It just wasn't practicable in that particular time in the church's history. So again, when Paul speaks to and exhorts with those wonderful words the elders of the church at Ephesus, he's not speaking to guys who, as a team, lead one giant congregation. He's speaking to the individual pastors over home congregations scattered throughout Ephesus and the entire region. Well, there's a couple more that I can just list here. We have the use of overseer only being in the singular in the pastoral letters. This is interesting because the fact that overseer and bishop is only spoken of in the singular in the pastoral epistles, that's in contrast to the plurality of deacons and even the plurality of elders as it's described other places. Now, this certainly isn't to say that there were not some churches in New Testament times that were run by a plurality of elders. I don't doubt that at all. But I'm saying that it means something that when Paul references overseer in the pastoral epistles, it's always in the singular and never in the plural. One other thing that I would note is that in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, we see that when Peter describes the work of elders, pastors, he says this, look at verse 2. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Now notice this. He tells them to shepherd the flock of God. And then in verse 3, he continues, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you. Now please notice this. Paul gives the specific references, or excuse me, Peter gives the specific references to pastoral ministry there. And he tells these pastors, you have the potential for lording over people. Friends, if they were in a purely plurality of elders, there would be very little danger of one individual pastor lording it over others. But they were in a position where they might abuse their position, and that's why they had to be warned otherwise. And then one other point, this is my eighth point on this subpoint. He says that pastors have congregations allotted to them. If you look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 3, it says that they should serve willingly, not for dishonest gain, as it says, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. You see, those entrusted to you is more literally the portion allotted to each individual. The idea is that those particular shepherds had a portion of the flock of God allotted to them that they were supposed to take leadership over. So again, I think that it's overwhelming in the New Testament that the idea of a pastor-led church is entirely biblical. Sometimes those who advocate the rule of elders only, they're frustrated because the New Testament doesn't use the word pastor enough for their liking. But the model of pastoral leadership, or should I say, not leadership by committee, is throughout the New Testament. And it's far more prominent and developed than any other form of leadership. I mean, look at the examples we have, and I'll just click through them quickly. We have the example of Jesus, the example of Paul and the apostles. We have the example of Timothy. We have the example of Titus. We have the example of James. We have the use of overseer in the singular. We have pastors having the potential for lording over in 1 Peter chapter 5. And we have pastors with congregations allotted to them in 1 Peter chapter 3. No, I've read all the books that advocate that elder rule is the only form of biblical church government. And when I read them deal with all this, I find it fascinating. They just dismiss these all as special cases. I'm not going to quote specifically, but this is the tone, this is the tenor. They say, well, you know, Jesus didn't lead by committee. And they say, well, are you Jesus? No, I'm not Jesus. Well, you know, Paul didn't lead by committee. Well, are you Paul? Well, no, I'm not Paul. Well, Timothy didn't lead by committee. Well, are you Timothy? Well, no, I'm not Timothy. Well, you know, Peter gave this. Well, are you in the first century? On and on and on, without recognizing that if every case is somehow a special case, maybe God's trying to communicate something through the New Testament. But again, as I did at the beginning, let me say this again. I have no quarrel with those who prefer an elder rule structure instead of a senior pastor structure. My disagreement is with those who would say that the pastor-led model is unbiblical, and that I would flatly deny from all these examples given from the New Testament. All right, with my time remaining, let me discuss my fourth point, which I believe is also a very important point, and it's one that I've been thinking about a lot lately. The fourth point is simply this. The pastor-led model recognizes that there is an appropriate and legitimate authority and leadership in the pulpit. You see, beyond the biblical argument, I also favor the senior pastor structure simply because I believe it's the most honest. Friends, do you know how leadership works in human organizations? Leadership works in human organizations where invariably a person takes the lead. Contemplate in your mind for a moment a congregational form of church government. And let's just say you have 100 members in the church. Congregational form of church government, 100 members in the church. Let me ask you something. Do all of those 100 members carefully and thoughtfully and prayerfully make up their own opinion? It doesn't work that way. You know how it works? There's leaders in the congregation. There's brother, let's call him Brother Fred. There's Brother Fred in the congregation. And for whatever reason, maybe Brother Fred is a very spiritual man. Maybe Brother Fred really knows the scriptures. Maybe Brother Fred is a successful businessman. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, people in that congregation really respect Brother Fred. Who really runs that church? Brother Fred. Because when Brother Fred raises his hand and says, I think the coffee cup should be this color, most people will side with him, and he runs the church. Now, he may run in a good way, he may run in a bad way, but that's just the nature of human organizations. Now think about an elder-led form of church government. You got a group of, let's say, 7 people on the elder board. There they are, all together on the elder board. Now, do each one of them come up with their own spiritual, really thoughtfully prayed out? Now, it's much more likely that you'd get that among the seven than you would among the 100. But still, the dynamics of human leadership are such that usually there's an elder on that board who, for whatever reason, it might be a good reason, it might be a bad reason, but there's an elder on that board who has a place of leadership among them all. Let's call him Elder Fred. And Elder Fred, again, it might be for a good and godly reason, it might be for a carnal reason, I don't really know. But when Elder Fred says his opinion on the board, pretty much that's the way it's going to go. And then the third form of church government, you have Pastor Fred. And Pastor Fred is in the pulpit each and every week, and he leads the thing, and hopefully he leads as a team leader, not as a dictator leader, but as a team leader. And he works with his elders, he works with the congregation, he has a heart for them. But what I'm just saying is, you can have Brother Fred, or Elder Fred, or Pastor Fred, but invariably, leadership comes to a person. And I think that the form of church government that says pastor-led, it isn't the best in every situation, but where there are qualified men to lead and where the culture around it will accept it at the beginning or be taught to accept it, I think it's the best biblical model. Friends, there is an appropriate authority that goes with the pulpit. I remember one time I was at a conference. And there was a man who's a professor at a seminary. I won't say his name just because I don't want to introduce any controversy into it, but he's a good man. He's written some good books, and he was a good man, and I was very thankful for his contributions at that particular conference. He and his speaking sessions at that conference, he was trying to make the point that elder-led form of church government is the only biblical model. So he's making his points from Acts and this and that. Then afterwards, in a very gracious way, he invited questions from the audience. Well, I was also speaking at the conference, so he and I knew each other, and I was fascinated by a couple of things he said in his presentation. One of the things he said was that he serves as an elder at his Presbyterian church. So he knows the inner workings of his particular church government and how they relate to the pastor and all that. And as he was speaking, he threw out a line that said basically this, about how he and the other elders tend to defer to the pastor in many decisions. They tend to defer and take the pastor's leadership and the pastor's wisdom. And the other thing I knew about this man was that this man was familiar with many Calvary Chapel pastors and Calvary Chapel churches. So after he'd finished his presentation, which I thought was a good presentation, I asked a couple questions. I said, "Doctor, you know, do you mind?" I was being very respectful of the man. He's a good man, and he deserves the respect. So I said, "Dr. So-and-so, may I ask you a couple of questions?" And he said, "Sure." And I said, "First of all, I have a question. You stated that the biblical idea was for a plurality of elders where everybody's equal and none is higher than the others." He goes, "Yes, that's correct." I said, "Then why do you defer to your pastor on your own elder board?" And he smiled, and he said, "Well, his head is just in the game more than any of us. He's in there day in, day out. He has the leadership of the pulpit." And I said, "Well, very true." I wasn't going to debate it. I just was pointing out that he made a very valid point. That even on his supposedly Presbyterian, elder, everybody's equal form of church government, they recognize the leadership of the pastor in their particular church. Secondly, I asked this as a follow-up question. I said, "Dr. So-and-so, you're familiar with many Calvary Chapel churches and pastors and the way that they work, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes, absolutely I am." I said, "On a practical level with how it actually works, how big is the difference between what you practice on your board at your church in relation to your pastor and what the Calvary Chapel pastors and churches that you know do in their church?" And he smiled, and he said, "There's very little difference." And what I just came to the conclusion right then was it really just sort of cemented for me an observation that I'd previously made. That practically speaking, many forms of church government work very similar. There's a man who has the authority of the pulpit, and he preaches week in and week out. And that gives him a unique position of influence and leadership in the church. It's appropriate that he has that because he leads the church from the pulpit. And that man works, hopefully, with wisdom and gentleness, yet authority, with a team of men that God has raised up to help lead the church, and it works together beautifully, and that's what I've seen in so many particular churches. I would suggest this. If you really want to have an elder-led form of church government, where nobody on that team of elders has any more authority than anybody else, then I think the only way that you can do that is to equally distribute the work of the pulpit among those elders. If you got six elders, then those six elders should share in the pulpit equally, because to do otherwise is to ignore the natural and the appropriate leadership and influence that flows from the pulpit. You know, look, when I think about these issues of church government, I am sorry for every believer who has had a bad experience with some form of church government. And they're out there. I don't doubt that I'm speaking to some now, that maybe you or maybe your families, you've been hurt by a pastor who misused his authority. You've been hurt by elders who misused their authority. You've been hurt by congregational leaders who misused their authority. I'm sorry for every one of those occasions. And yet I know from the hurts that I have experienced in my years of ministry, God can and does use even the painful times to mold us into his image, and if we will allow it, to make us better servants for him. But to say that a pastor-led church is unbiblical or inherently dangerous, friends, according to the scriptures, from my take completely, is simply false. I know that in my work as a pastor, I work in cooperative submission with our elders, and I would never be foolish enough to disregard their counsel or their accountability. Pastors who abuse their power have a strict judgment coming, either in this life or in the next, and this should make them very humble and open to correction. I'll say something else that I say to pastors. I say to pastors all the time that it's important for their churches to have a mechanism in their bylaws whereby a pastor can be removed from his office against his will if he's guilty of moral, doctrinal, or ethical error that's significant enough to justify his removal. I think there should be a mechanism in the bylaws where that can happen, even if the pastor doesn't want it. And most, I won't say all by any means, but most Calvary Chapel churches I know have such a mechanism in their bylaws, and I think it's healthy. It is possible for a pastor to go off the rails, and there should be a way of dealing with that if it happens. But for a pastor to actively build a team and to work together as a team in the leadership of the church, that is simply wise. And look, I know that perhaps not all pastors at all times work in this way, but when they fail to do it, it's a reflection on their own wisdom, or maybe I should say lack of wisdom, not on the structure itself. Friends, God has used the pastor-led model to accomplish great things for his kingdom in a godly way, and I believe that he'll continue to do so.